We can settle down. We'll get started. Good morning. My name is Laura Bellflower. I'm the hearing examiner for today's hearing. If everybody could settle down, appreciate it. Thank you. This is a hearing for DCI 2016-00024, a request for a rezoning to residential plan development. We have a lot of people here, and we have a lot of forms already. Okay, so what's going to happen is the applicant is going to go first. They're going to put on their witnesses, and if staff or I have any questions, we will ask the questions of each witness. If members of the public have questions, write them down, note them, some way that you can remember them, and you'll have an opportunity to ask them at the public portion. The members of the public cannot do cross-examination of each witness as they're standing up there, but you can ask questions and we'll get them answered. After the applicant makes their presentation, then we'll go to staff. Staff will make their presentation. We may have questions of staff. And then after the applicant and staff have gone, it'll be an opportunity for members of the public to speak. You need to fill out one of these forms for those of you who have not, if you wish to speak. You also can fill out the form if you wish to just receive a copy of the recommendation and a copy of the notice for the board hearing. So I will take those forms and I'll call each person up. You will have the opportunity to ask any questions that you want, make any comments that you want to. There is not a time limit. I ask that you don't be repetitious. If somebody else has already said something and you have nothing to add to that, to say I agree with what they said, and then add whatever point you have that is different or ask any other question. It is not a matter of how many people say the same thing. It's the quality of what you're saying that I really need your input on. After we go through all the names, you will only be able to speak once. So if you forgot something, tell it to somebody that hasn't already spoken and have them ask it. You have to speak here to be able to speak before the Board of County Commissioners. So you need to actually provide input here in this hearing to be able to do that. And I really want you to do that because I want everybody's input and everybody's information so that I can make the best recommendation. After the members of the public have finished speaking, we will come back to staff to see if there's any changes or any points that they want to answer, questions that the public had that they are the appropriate person to answer. And then we will go to the applicant who will do their rebuttal, answer any of the questions that are appropriate for the applicant to answer, and summarize at the end. Typically what we do is there are conditions that have been proposed for this. If I was to recommend approval, I would put those conditions out to recommend to the board. Typically we do the conditions after the members of the public have spoken. So if you want to suggest any conditions, et cetera, the opportunity to do that is during your presentation portion. We'll talk about the conditions, and then we will hopefully wrap up the hearing today. With this many people, it's entirely possible we may need to continue this to another day, so we'll see where we are when we get to the afternoon session, and it may need to be continued. After the hearing is finally closed, then I will take all the information. I have not done the site visit on this one yet, so I'll go out and do the site visit and look through all the evidence and make a written recommendation to the Board of County Commissioners. Then that is sent to the board, and they will hold a second public hearing, but the public hearing is very limited. Each person will not have more than 3 minutes to speak, so you need to say what you wanted to say here, and then it'll be just a very quick summary of any points that you felt were not adequately addressed in my recommendation one way or the other. Then the board will make the final decision on the case. Okay, So everybody needs to turn off your cell phone if you have a cell phone, and turn it off or put it into the quiet position. And everyone who is going to speak needs to speak under oath. So if you would please raise your right hand. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give will be the complete truth?
I do.
Okay. When you speak for the first time, please state your name and indicate whether or not you were sworn in. And with that, we will get started with the applicant.
Good morning. Neil Montgomery for the record. Before you, you just touched the copy of the PowerPoint, which is an exhibit noted in our 48-hour letter. I'm assuming that you have the 48-hour letter.
I do.
That indicates our areas of disagreement.
Yes, and you had marked the PowerPoint presentation as applicant's exhibit one, and it will be marked that way.
Okay,
thank you very much. The 48-hour letter is A.
Okay. Good morning. For the record, I am Neil Montgomery. I'm the attorney. At the hearing examiner indicated, we're going to be presenting witnesses. It's the applicant's job to provide expert testimony in support of their application. Our first witness is an expert in planning and land use, Jennifer Sapin, and she's going to go through the planning issues. Following that will be Barrett Day School. He's the environmental consultant. He'll go through all the issues regarding the critters and the plants. Following Barrett is Wes Kane, who's an engineer. I've heard that some of you have questions about flooding and other civil engineering aspects, and Wes will be addressing those issues. I've also heard that some of you have questions about traffic. Ted Treese is here. He's our expert in transportation, and he will be addressing those transportation issues. And Ron Inge is here. He's an expert in a myriad of topics, so we'll stay tuned as to what Ron has to deal with as part of the consideration of the application. I'm assuming everybody knows where we are, but it's a very large-scale aerial, just to orient you. I-75 is to the east, Bayshore is to the south, and the property has direct access to Slater Road. This is a narrower, more close-in look. Jennifer's going to elaborate. You're going to see, for the hearing examiner who read the staff report, the staff noted the C1 parcel to the north of the outdoor storage. You can clearly see that outdoor storage immediately to the north. You can see the retention ponds from the wastewater treatment plants to the south and a mobile home park. So Jennifer's going to elaborate on this, but it's definitely an area with a myriad of different types of uses going on. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to our expert in planning and zoning, Jennifer.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Jennifer Sapin. I am LEED certified and AICP certified. I have presented before this panel before, and my resume is on file, but I brought copies with me if you would like that. And I asked to be accepted as an expert witness in land planning and site planning design.
Okay. On your resume, is it different from what has been filed with the?
No, it's the same.
Okay. Then we don't need it. We already have it on record. Staff have any objection to recognizing as an expert? So accept it.
The request is a rezoning from AG2 to RPD for 66 acres. The 66 acres is shown here in the slide, and it's located in the North Fort Myers planning community. As required by Land Development Code Section 33-1532, we met with that planning community on July 11th, 2017 at the North Fort Myers Recreation Center. The panel did recommend approval of the project. As you can also see on the aerial, the property is predominantly cleared to the east and the west. The middle of the site, there is some vegetation, and there's a creek running through the middle of the site. There is an agricultural exemption on the property, and there are cattle on the property right now. The project is in two future land use categories, mostly in the suburban, shown here in the yellow color. And there's a portion, 11 acres of it, is in the rural future land use. Abutting the property is predominantly suburban to the east, west, south, and a portion of the project to the north. And in the northwest of the project is a continuation of rural. As required by policy 1.1.5, the rural future land use allows only one dwelling unit per acre. At 11 acres, you are allowed 11 units in that portion of the project. Suburban per policy 1.4.1 allows 6 dwelling units per acre. Applying that to 55 acres allows a density of 330 units. This means the total allowable density for the project is 341. The request today is slightly below that at 330, making the proposal and the requested density compliant with both of these land use policies. Shown here is the zoning map. The subject property shown in pink is currently AG2. Abutting the property are a myriad of different zoning categories and land uses. Starting on Slater Road on the north side of the property, it's zoned C1, and that is the outdoor storage that Neil referenced. It appears to be an outdoor industrial type use storage facility. Continuing on east along the north property line, AG2 abuts the property. As you get to the east side of the project, there is a development called Oak Creek, which is an RPD, a residential plan development. Further to the east, there's just a tiny corner of the site that touches a mixed-use development. As staff noted in their report, there was a mistake in the property appraisers showing that as an industrial plan development, but that is a mixed-use plan development. Continuing south, but along the east property line, it is zoned AG2. This is where the school is, and you can see in the back there's some ball fields. On the south side of the property, there is AG2. On the east side, directly on the east, on the southern boundary, but towards the east side, you see there's a vacant area with a parking lot. That's for a recreation facility for Lee County, and that's zoned AG2. Continuing on, there are some larger estate lots zoned AG2. And then there's a mobile home community, the River Trails mobile home community, and that is zoned MH2. And moving towards Slater Road, it is also zoned AG2. And the other side of Slater Road on the west is AG2. The request complies with policy 1.7.6, which allocates acreage towards the residential use in this particular community, planning community. In suburban, there are nearly 7,000 acres available. The request is only 55. For rural, there are 500 acres available, and the request is for 11. The request, therefore, is compliant with policy 1.7.6. Some other policies the project is compliant with are listed here. Objective 2.1, policies 2.1.1 and 2.1.2, and objective 2.2, policy 2.2.1, and policy 5.1.3. All of these policy and objectives refer to existing infrastructure, meaning schools, police, fire, bus. And I have a few slides that I'm going to go through to show those. We're also compliant with water and sewer standards 4.1.1 and 4.1.2. You do have letters of availability in the staff report, and Wes Kane, our engineer, will go through that in a little bit more detail, but I wanted to point out that it is in compliant with those policies, or those standards, rather. So this map shows the police, fire, medical and EMS, and the LETRAN within the vicinity of the site. EMS Station 31, it's located on Garden Street, which is north of Laurel. There is also a fire station pretty close to the site, fire station number 3. It's within 1 mile of the site. You can see just a little bit further south of that, it's the bus stop for LETRAN Route 590. That's about a mile and a half from the site. And the Lee County Sheriff's Office is located in North Fort Myers off Pondella Road, and across the Coosawhatchie River is the Lee Memorial Hospital. There are several schools that are nearby to serve the site. Bayshore Elementary, of course, is right next to the site in the southeast corner of the project. North Fort Myers Academy of Arts, which is grades K through 8, so that does include middle school. And then North Fort Myers High School is a little bit off this slide, off to the bottom left. There is a library and a senior center located in North Fort Myers. And that location there is where we had the North Fort Myers community planning meeting. Residents of Gully Creek can enjoy many opportunities for shopping, employment, and parks. There's several of them shown here. Of course, the soccer complex that I pointed out that abuts the project is very close. Caloosahatchee Creeks Preserve is near I-75. There are opportunities for employment at Raymond Lumber, a couple of different public shopping centers, and Merchants Crossing. There's a nice disc golf facility, which is just north of this in this pretty regional community center. So there are several different services and infrastructure establishments in place to serve the site. Next, I want to switch to looking at compatibility. I'll go through a few slides which will demonstrate compliance with Goal 5, Objective 5.1, and Policies 5.1.5 and 5.1.10. In doing that, I'm going to look at the definition of compatibility as it's defined by the Lee County Land Development Code. That definition is stated here. Compatibility means describing the relation between two land uses, buildings or structures, or zoning districts, the state wherein those two things exhibit either a positive relationship based on fit, similarity, or reciprocity of characteristics, or a neutral relationship based on a relative lack of conflict, actual or potential, or on a failure to communicate negative or harmful influences to one another. You can see here I've highlighted a few words in bold and colored them in yellow. Those are the portions of the definition that I'm going to key on in the next few slides. We're going to look at the relationship between two land uses, the two land uses being what is proposed and what is either existing or already approved. And then we're going to look at the similarity of those two characteristics and determine whether or not there is a relative lack of conflict. First, we'll look at the density. And to study density, I have studied all of the residential projects shown here in blue. It's not all of the residential in the area, but it is a good sampling of the residential in the area, the trends that are going on right now, and the existing built communities. You can see here, shown in yellow, is Gully Creek Request. At 5 units per acre, it's towards the top of this list of all these residential developments, but it's not the greatest. There are other residential developments along Bayshore Road and along Slater Road that have similar higher density. Again, remember that we're looking at the relationship between the uses and if they're similar or relative lack of conflict. I would submit that even with a density towards the high of the chart, there's a relative lack of conflict for a density request of 4.5 acres to 5 acres. Next, we're going to narrow the scope and look at only the residential plan developments, well, two residential plan developments and one mixed-use plan development that abut the project and are contiguous to the east. These projects are Oak Creek, shown to the north, Chapel Creek right along Bayshore, and Bayshore 57, also along Bayshore. The table here looks at first the residential type, so this category here. As you can see, the residential types proposed by these three developments are the same, identical in every instance, except Gully Creek is also proposing a two-family attached product. That product wasn't proposed in the other projects. They were approved several years ago, and that wasn't a product that was trending. It is now, and the market it seeks a two-family attached, which is essentially a duplex, but it's a fee simple, where each side of the structure is owned by a different landowner, and the lot line runs through the middle. So it's like a two-unit townhouse, fee simple. So that product is added to the Gully Creek request. So I've colored the cells in green, where what is proposed is either the same or less intense than what is already existing. So you can see the lot sizes, lot width, depth, height, and product type for these three projects abutting Gully Creek are equal or less intense. This means that the proposed regulations and the proposed development type, residential type, showing the relation between these two, they are obviously have similar characteristics, very the exact same characteristic in several instances, meaning there's a relative lack of conflict. But also want to point out there are some numbers here that are shown red. Those are where Oak Creek, Chapel Creek, and Bayshore 57 are more intense than what Gully Creek is proposing. For example, if you look at the townhouses, Gully Creek is proposing a 2,000 square foot townhouse as a minimum size. Chapel Creek, Bayshore 57, and Oak Creek all propose townhouses smaller than that. They also propose an 18 foot wide townhouse. We are proposing a 20 foot wide townhouse. So in several cases, our request is less intense than the three projects that abut us that have already been approved. Going back to that first map where we looked at a greater study area with more blue, this is the same map that we looked at for the density. Looking at that study map again, I've added in more projects. I've also added in a yellow cell. There is one yellow cell. When you add in Bayshore Commons, the single family lot width for Bayshore Commons is wider than what we are proposing at 50 foot. I've also added in all the mobile home communities. These regulations are what is required in the MH2 zoning district. As you can see here, this table pretty clearly shows that the blue residential projects shown on this map are of similar characteristic to what is proposed, and therefore there's a relative lack of conflict, proving that the proposed request is compatible with the existing residential projects. Moving on to the site plan, we've colored in here. Generally, the lakes are blue and the preserve is green. The main entrance of the project is off Slater Road. The entrance to the project, there's a throat depth of about 550 feet from Slater Road to that first intersection. So this makes that lake shown there. That lake is about 400 feet deep, or from Slater into the first residential. That's important for the residents driving along Slater. They will be assured they're not going to be looking at the back of houses and the back of pool cages right up along Slater. They'll have 400 feet of lake to look across before they see residential units. Continue driving into the main entrance. Because it's the main entrance and the unique shape of the project boundary, this road is single loaded, so you'll have driveways on only one side of the road for a good portion of that main entrance road. You curve on around through, and you can see in the middle, the green, that's where the creek crossing is. And in the first aerial I showed you, that's where the vegetation is. And that's where our preservation and our indigenous preserve requirements are met in that green area. Continuing on, looking far down at the southeast portion of the site, that's our second entrance. That's access from Williams Road, which goes along that school down there. We have a third potential optional access. It's shown with the pink arrow here on the east side. This is for an optional potential future connection to Oak Creek. If that connection were to be made to Oak Creek would need to amend their zoning plan. We wanted to allow this project to be able to connect to Oak Creek to provide the option for that in the future if Oak Creek was amended. We wanted to do that rather than needing to come through and amend both projects. We just wanted to provide the opportunity for interconnectivity. There are goals in the comprehensive plan about interconnectivity between projects, and we just wanted to provide that opportunity should Oak Creek amend their development. You also see in the slide the residential areas, R2 and R1, colored slightly different here. R2 on the left side of the screen, that is the more intense uses. Both sides of the project allow single-family detached and that fee simple two-family attached. However, only on the west side of the project in the R2 will townhouses and multifamily be allowed. We have a second master concept plan. The west side is the same. The only change is to add a little more lake on the east side of the project. Next, I want to look at buffers and give you an aerial zoom in a little bit so you can see how we're buffering and what the adjacent land uses are. Starting at the commercial area in C1, the black indicates a type A buffer, which is a 5 foot wide buffer that'll run along the lake. Then you hit a small area of P pink. The pink buffer represents a type C or F buffer. This is required when a road is within 125 feet of existing residential uses. The option would be a C buffer, it's 15 feet wide, but a wall is required, or a type F buffer, which is 30 feet wide, and it has twice as many trees. Continuing on, the yellow is where no buffer is required. Then we hit the CF buffer along the preserves, of course, no buffer required. And continuing around the project, anywhere where residential abuts residential, there's no buffer required, but where the road gets near that project boundary, that C or F buffer is required. Looking down here in the blue indicates a type B as in boy buffer. That's a 15-foot wide buffer. And continuing on around, no buffer in yellow, CF in pink, and then a type A buffer. This buffer type A, shown here and up here, that is not a required buffer. That triggers in of a condition of a deviation that I'll go through in a minute. And then you round up with a CF buffer along the residential here, and then along Slater Road, the green is a type D as in dog buffer. Earlier when I spoke about the R1, R2, that also ties into the open space calculations. The whole site is 66 acres. This R1 category, no multifamily, and the residential lots, single family, are a minimum lot size of 6,500 square foot, and both the two-family attached and the single family are capped at 45% lot coverage. By doing that, pushing the larger lots on the west side, no open space is required for that portion of the project. To calculate that, we drew a line down the center line of the creek, which was survey located, and separated the whole project in that way. So the east side of the project, the R1 area, was 29 acres. We subtracted that from the total project, meaning that the portion of the project that requires open space is 37.3 acres, and being the R2 area. Applying that at 40%, 14.9 acres is required. We are providing slightly more at 15.7, almost an acre more. This slide shows a zoomed in and color version. This is shown on the master concept plan. I think the colors help understand what's going on a little bit better. We comply with the Land Development Code sections listed here. The first one is 10415B. That's a section that requires that half of your open space requirements be met through on-site indigenous preserve. The next code section listed here, 10416B3A, is the code which allows for incentive credits for contiguous preservation areas. We did purposefully locate our indigenous preserve, not only where the preserve is, but along the creek. It's a very pretty creek, and it has some nice trees in here. This singular contiguous vegetation will create a good habitat, which Barrett Saitskull, our environmental consultant, can get into a little bit more. But the green area is what qualifies as indigenous preserve. The brown crosshatched area is non-indigenous, so that doesn't count towards our indigenous preserve. However, it will be within the conservation easement. Those areas go towards our just general open space requirements. The request also is compliant with, and this, I apologize, this is the wrong code section. It should be 10416D9. And 416D9 requires a 50-foot waterway buffer to natural waterways. That buffer is shown here in a black dashed line. And you can see that that buffer doesn't extend into any residential lots, and it also does not extend into the lake abutting the property or the preserve. The 48-hour letter did include a proposed change to conditions 10A and 10B, both regarding the gopher tortoise. Barrett will go into that a little bit more detail. I just wanted to explain how it applies to the site plan. The light green area is all the area that will be inside of a conservation easement. The hatched area is where the gopher tortoise preservation area is. So he can explain why and how that applies to the gopher tortoise. I just wanted you to understand from a site plan standpoint of where the gopher tortoise is located, and that there would be additional preserve beyond the gopher tortoise preserve area. I mentioned earlier there is 11 acres in the rural future land use that's shown here with the crosshatch. In accordance with policy 5.1.10, no density may be allocated from the suburban into the rural. Therefore, this area of the project has a density cap of 11 units, being 11 acres. You can see there's a small residential area here where those 11 units would be applied. Getting into the deviations, the first three I will do together since the reason behind them and the function of them are easy to group together. They apply to these small little dead-end roads that you see here. There's two areas of the site where this occurs, but they both function in the same way. The first deviation is from 10254, which requires that side lot lines be at right angles to streets. So this side lot line is at a right angle to the street. When you turn the lot sideways, this becomes your front lot line, the edge, the terminal edge of the right-of-way, and this becomes your side lot line. This side lot line then is not perpendicular to the road, it's parallel to the road. So a deviation is needed to accommodate this design. The next deviation is from 10296, P as in Paul 1. This is the code which requires cul-de-sacs at the end of dead-end streets. I'll get into that in a little bit more detail on the justification to that. The third deviation is just to determine how lots are measured. We've asked for this deviation in several other cases and have found that this graphic here just helps for future evaluation because it is unusual to have this as your side lot line and this is your front lot line. This graphic just helps for future permitting to be clear of where setbacks are measured and how lot size is measured. Here's an example, a recent example. This is Camden Square. The zoning was approved in 2014 through resolution Z14015, and these same three deviations were requested and approved in that project. This is that lot, what it looks like. Your road comes and then it terminates, and then his whole lot is shown here in blue. It creates a premium lot for the project. Developers sell this lot for a premium, and they're usually one of the first lots that are sold in the project. Part of the reason it creates additional open space. You can see here there's a lot of grass area. The road, this is where the road terminates, and then the private driveway begins here, a nice paved driveway. An additional benefit to the project is that it requires less land. Because the road right-of-way doesn't have to get larger for the cul-de-sac, there's less land dedicated to right-of-way, and more can be privately developed or used for other purposes of the project. Looking at public safety, the Florida Fire Prevention Code, they allow dead-end streets as long as the dead-end does not exceed 150 feet. It's the Land Development Code, which has a greater criteria. So the request is from the Land Development Code, but Florida Fire Code allows it. And if you look at our detail, and this is showing the master concept plan, we show here that this must be less than 150 feet. As conditioned in the staff report, it will require approval from the local fire district prior to development order. We wait until development order to get that approval because at some of the questions that the fire department comes up with, they want to know where your fire hydrants are going to be, and we just don't know that yet at this time. And this has proven success in other Lee County developments. I listed Camden Square. There is also Three Oaks 106 RPD, Enclaves RPD, and Oakview RPD. I have copies of all four zoning resolutions. If you would like those, I can give them to you.
If you'd like to submit them, yes. Yes, since you had numbered your number two already.
Number two is going to be a letter from Ron Ng to Richard Schein. And this will be number three. It's a composite exhibit of multiple approved RPD projects?
Correct.
Okay.
Without deviations.
Correct, yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Next deviation four, is from Land Development Code Section 10329 D as in dog 1A3. This requires an excavation setback to a property boundary where there is a separate ownership. It requires 50 feet. The request is to allow 30 feet. This section of the code requires excavation setbacks not just to property boundary under separate ownership, but also along public right-of-way. I wanted to point out that there is no request for a reduced excavation setback to Slater Road. There will be a 50-foot excavation setback to Slater Road. The deviation does apply where the yellow four triangles are shown here in the project. As conditioned by staff, there will be a 5-foot wide type A buffer provided there. And that's the earlier slide. You can see that there was a type A buffer required wherever the excavation setback is less than 50 feet. This will protect from pedestrians. It will delineate where the project boundary is so that it eliminates safety concerns. The benefit to the project is through the enhancement and optimum use of the land. It increases the on-site lake excavation material, which is a cost savings to the developer, but it also reduces construction traffic on public roads. From a public safety standpoint, the applicant agrees to the safety barriers that staff has recommended in their conditions, and therefore there's no detriment to the public safety, health, or welfare through approval of this deviation. The next deviation, number five, is from Land Development Code Section 10285A. This requires an intersection separation of 440 feet. The request is to allow 170 feet. This is to B. Charmer Lane, shown here on this slide. We located the proposed access, shown here in black. We located where it is as far south on the project as possible to achieve an equal distance between what we are looking at as more intense uses along Slater Road, whether it be from a traffic trip standpoint or just from the type of vehicles coming and going. Here we have the industrial storage yard, where you can see there would be large tractor trailer type vehicles coming and going. Similar with Zents Landscaping down here. We would expect that they would have trucks with trailers. So our intent was to locate the access point halfway between these two more intense scenarios. Those two yellow lines shown here are about 800 feet each one. B. Charmer Lane, shown right here, and shown here on this side, on this line. Reducing the intersection separation to this road is not a detriment to the public safety, health, and welfare, because the road essentially functions as a private driveway. You see here, it's a dirt road, and it is not county maintained. Shown from an aerial view, it's also not a detriment to public safety, health, and welfare, because it is a low traffic generator, as you can tell by the dirt road. And it's also good to note that there is no through connection of that road to Shelby Lane. The benefit to this deviation by moving this access point as far south as possible, it allows for the opportunity to put a very large water management lake to separate and buffer our main entrance where we intend to landscape it and look very nice. We wanted to separate that as much as possible from the outdoor industrial storage yard. That concludes my presentation, but I'm available for questions.
I have a couple questions. Jennifer, can I get you to go back to slide 20? I kind of want to go around this one more time. Just, you indicated earlier that it's over 400 feet from Slater Road to the closest house. But when I look at this slide, it's over 400 feet, plus you have a type D buffer. Is that correct?
That's correct. And, well, it's You have over 400 feet of lake. The lake is set back 50 feet from the right-of-way, as required by Land Development Code.
I don't think know that the folks know what a Type D buffer is. Is that one of the more intense buffers in the county code?
Well, it is a Type D as in dog buffer. It is 15 feet wide. Let me find a slide. It is 15 feet wide, and it requires 5 trees for every 100 linear feet. You have to provide 5 trees. There's also a requirement for a double hedge. So you would see every 100 feet, 5 trees, double hedge, and behind that you would see a lake for 400 feet. And then behind that would be the backside of these residential houses.
So since very few residences appear to actually live next to this property, it's going to be minimal impact. Will it have a minimal impact on the traveling public on Slater Road?
Correct. If anything, the traveling public on Slater Road will be enhanced by having a landscape buffer that will be maintained by the Homeowners Association, and you'll have a lake view. From aesthetic standpoint, it will improve this area.
If there's going to be comments or conversations, please take them out in the hall. The microphones pick up very well, and it's very distracting. I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
You have public recreation facilities noted there. Is that outdoor recreation field with kids and noise and traffic?
Correct. That was the Bayshore Soccer Complex that we had on one of the public service slides. Yeah, the Bayshore Soccer Complex. And there's a pretty good-sized parking lot right here with the outdoor play field here. And then there's play fields here as well.
So this site abuts a myriad of uses, some very intense, like the C1 and the soccer fields and the mobile home and the RPD. And some less developed with the AG2 residential uses. But there's no house immediately adjacent to this property.
Along this portion of the site and in the south towards the east, these residential houses are set back very far, what I would guess that at least 300 or feet or so from the property boundary of open space. So none of these houses are near. There is a house right here that is somewhat near. Let's see. Yeah, maybe in Niels. There we go. You can see it here. And it's a single family house, but there are several different additions added in the back here with sheds. But that is the only residential home that is near the site. Single family estate other than the mobile home community down here.
So the two places where the public can actually experience this property are going to be Slater Road and Williams Road. And will this development change the character visible from either of those roads?
It will not negatively change the character. If anything, it will improve the aesthetics along Slater.
Okay. I don't have any other questions.
Staff have any questions?
I have one, if I may, Madam Hearing Examiner.
Mm-hmm.
Chip Block with the Department of Community Development. Jennifer, if I could get you back to the previous slide of slide 20, where you had the colored buffers. Just for purposes of making sure for the record, the pink that you have there is a proposal for either a C or an F buffer, or a D or an F buffer, I apologize, D or F buffers. Am I correct?
C or F, correct.
The F is 30 foot wide.
Correct.
Having looked at this as part of the design aspects, are you sure that a 30-foot buffer will be achievable within that area? I just want to make sure that for purposes down the road that we're not looking at a possible deviation request down the road. I wanted to make sure it was achievable.
If for a design reason the 30-foot would not be achievable, then the applicant would then be required to use a Type C buffer,
okay,
which is only 15 feet wide, but a wall would be required. with landscaping on the outside of the wall. Anytime a wall is proposed by a new plan development, the landscaping must be on the outside of the wall towards the public.
Thank you. Only question I have.
I have one question. Beth Workman, for the record, with the zoning section. The deviation, I believe it was deviation 4, and we can keep it on this slide, was for going from a 50-foot excavation to a 30-foot, correct?
That's correct.
The condition that was proposed in the staff report, you had mentioned a type A. And a type A buffer is 5 feet wide with 5 trees every 100 feet. But the condition was an enhanced type A, which then provided shrubs, a single hedgerow, which our code is a type A with just trees. Is that correct?
I got an email at 3:30 this morning where that was noticed. Your memo has on there a double hedge, but I don't believe it was in the staff report and conditions, and we didn't notice it until 3:30 this morning. The applicant would agree to an enhanced buffer where that deviation is applied, so that the type A buffer would include a double hedge.
Okay, because I'm hearing the same. I'm looking at my environmental staff report, mm-hmm. and it reads, prior to development order approval, the development order plans must illustrate a 5 foot wide enhanced type A buffer. And that includes 5 trees per 100 linear feet and a hedgerow installed at 48 inches in height, where lake excavation is 30 feet from the property line. If an optional project wall or fence is proposed, then a 7.5 foot buffer must be provided. And that was in the environmental staff report.
Yeah, and the simple answer is, Beth is correct, that condition is recommended at the end of her staff report, is not included, that I could find it in the list of conditions. And so we saw that and emailed each other and go, well, what about this? And so it's an oversight. It needs to be included.
Okay, so... Chip, do you know whether that was just an accident that it was missed, or?
No, ma'am, it wasn't missed, as a matter of fact.
Oh.
If the applicant,
see that.
If you would, please go to page 4 of attachment C, which is the conditions and deviations of the staff report.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to page 4, under deviation 4, the condition is recommended there under the approval of deviation 4.
Okay, so
it's the same language that...
it is in the staff report, okay.
No, at least we found it.
Okay.
Sometimes you do see it in the conditions of the staff report specified.
Right.
Sometimes you see it in the condition under the deviations, and in this case, the condition is in the deviation action.
Thank you.
All right, so we don't need to change that. I did notice on your graphic that the lake that is to the north, yes.
Yeah.
So that should be black.
Correct.
And in option 2, it would be the enhanced type A along the whole northern part of that lake that you were proposing in the second option, correct?
Correct. And the master concept plans, I'm looking at them now, they are labeled correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Just the coloring on this graphic is not correct.
Okay. So I have a couple of questions. Are there any existing large lot residential subdivisions around this property as defined under the North Fort Myers Chapter 33 provisions that would require adjustments to the site?
Subdivisions. Maybe I'll get a location map. Here we go. There are several AG2 larger residential lots on the west side of Slater Road. And of course, there are the two that are on the east side of Slater Road directly south of the project. And there are some over here. So there are larger residential lots. The study area that I showed was just the blue area. So there are larger lots in the area. But I would say that this is a transitional area. There's a lot going on here. There is a trend, you can see with the residential plan developments that have been approved in the last 10 or so years, of a higher density residential.
Okay. The definition under Chapter 33, under 1537, says existing large lot residential subdivision means a residential subdivision where the minimum lot size is 14,520 square feet and is either or has been approved as of January 2012. So the key, I guess, in that is the word subdivision.
Correct.
So to your knowledge, these are meets and bounds lots. They have not been subdivided as a large lot subdivision. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So it's your opinion that the North Fort Myers standards relative to large lot residential subdivisions don't come into play with this project. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. I'm going to ask staff to confirm that.
While you're looking for that, let me ask Jennifer another question.
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer, you gave an example of when you were talking about some of the deviations about Camden Square, and those lots would be comparable to family lots here.
That's correct.
And to the north of Camden Square, is that 5-acre tracts?
Yeah, the example site that Neil's referring to off of Plantation Road, it is very similar in residential type that was approved. And just to the north of that project are very large estate residential projects or residential home sites that are, it's not a subdivision. It's similar to here. They're meets and bounds residential lots.
And that was found compatible by the Board of County Commissioners?
Correct, correct. It was found compatible, and it's constructed, and it looks very nice.
Okay. My question was not about compatibility at that point. It's whether the North Fort Myers requirements kick in place.
You reminded
me
of that. I wrote that question down and forgot it, so you were just helping me out.
Okay. Glad to do that. Okay, if we can go back to one of the slides that shows the R1 areas versus the R2 areas. And my question is, the R2 area you said is more intensely developed. What was the thought in putting the more intense development to the west versus to the east, closer to the existing RPDs or existing plan developments?
I think that is best shown in our zoning map. There we go. This area here are large residential lots, and this is a cleared ag area. Lower intensity on this side of the site from existing standpoints from the north and the south. When you get over closer to Slater Road, you have the C1, a more intense use, and you have the treatment ponds. Also, that's the main project access is on Slater Road. And there are goals and design parameters to put the more intense, higher density closer to the entrance of a project rather than the back side of the project.
On your site plan, it shows optional private recreational area, and this may not be a question for you. Let me know. And my question is, are those optional private recreational areas counted toward open space and in the open space calculations, and can they be recreation areas and still count as open space?
Yes, they are counted as open space. The intent of those, they're pretty small, little areas like this. The intent of those are really just pocket parks. Mostly it will be nothing but sodded green open space, maybe a gazebo there. It's a small common area for people to walk their dogs. During the development order review and approval, we will go through a process where we have to show on a plan what is open space and what counts as open space. In that instance, we'll follow land development code. There are criteria there that will allow sidewalks to be in open space. You could even have tennis courts in open space. So it's not necessarily relative to pervious or impervious. It's more of a use.
Okay. And again, you may not be the person to ask this, but there was, in your 48-hour letter, you raised a question that I was going to raise as well about the existing agriculture and listing that as a use. And staff's response is, are you the right person to talk to about that, or you have another witness that's going to talk about that?
No.
She's the right person? Okay. So the 48-hour letter, the applicant asked that it be listed in the schedule of uses, the agriculture, is that correct?
Correct.
Existing
agriculture, okay. And staff has indicated it's not necessary because of Note 48, and we'll let staff get into it. First of all, I would think that even existing ag can't be listed as a use in the schedule of uses because it's not a use allowed in RPD, but it's been handled in the past as a separate condition. Mm-hmm. Is that what you were thinking of, how it's been handled in the past and how?
Well, yeah, and the problem is that the staff has pointed out that the regulations have changed.
Right.
And when you read the regulations, it indicates that if you're existing ag, you're okay. So whether that be in a separate condition or the list of uses that acknowledges that there's existing ag, somehow what the applicant is seeking is the protection of not having a debate later about whether there was or wasn't existing ag, but acknowledging that there is, in fact, existing ag.
Okay. So you're just wanting to get that clarified so that it's not something that has to be debated each time.
We don't want you to get hit by a bus, but if he does, we don't want there to be any question about whether there's existing ag.
Okay. And I will note that when we talk to staff about it, that there is still a requirement in the code that there be an ag affidavit submitted. And I saw that there was.
Correct.
That's what raised it in my mm-hmm. mind is, wait a minute, where's the ag? Okay. All right, so we'll talk to staff about addressing that. Okay, that's the questions I have of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're going to be more than a half an hour?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
I have two slides. I'll be quick. Good morning. My name is Barrett Stay School with Bear Paws Environmental. I've been previously identified as an expert witness in wetland and wildlife ecology.
Any objection to recognize?
No, ma'am.
So accepted.
All right. First, I'm going to talk about the on-site wetlands. The on-site wetlands are located within the central portion of the property here. Basically, the creek on both sides of the extent of the wetlands that currently exist on site. These wetlands, as you can see here, have been incorporated into the preserve and include indigenous and non-indigenous areas. The next information I'm going to discuss is regarding the gopher tortoise. We've discussed with staff and come up to this condition, revised condition 10A. Prior to the issuance of a development order, an off-site management plan will be prepared, which will address all gopher tortoises that will be relocated within the development footprint.
Slow down just a little bit.
To an off-site FWC-approved mitigation bank. Also, prior to the development order, an on-site protected species management plan will be prepared, which will address both on-site and off-site relocation of gopher tortoise to the preserve areas and non-indigenous preserve areas.
So, Mr. Stateskill, what we're trying to clarify here, I believe, is we want it to be clear that some of the tortoises will be relocated off-site. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am, correct. Any gopher tortoises located within the preserve areas, whether it's indigenous or just classified as non-indigenous preserve, will remain on-site. Gopher tortoises located outside of the preserve areas within the development footprint will be relocated to an off-site FWC-approved recipient site.
And you'll have to do that in accordance with their
in
permitting
accordance
criteria.
You'll have to go through the permit and get a permit to do that from FWC.
Okay, and that's consistent with the current county requirements as
yes,
well?
Ma'am.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Staff have any questions?
No, ma'am.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Next condition is condition B, also discussing the gopher tortoise. Prior to a clearing permit, pursuant to the vegetation removal permit, the gopher tortoise fence will be installed around the limits of the preserve to ensure that no impacts will occur to any gopher tortoise's burrows located within the preserve. Gopher tortoises located within a 25-foot buffer area of the preserves shall either be relocated into the preserve or relocated off-site in accordance with the FWC criteria. And again, it's just as we discussed, this will all be mandated within the FWC permit for the gopher tortoises. As discussed with staff, no machinery or mechanical excavation of gopher tortoise burrows can occur within the indigenous preserve or on-site preserve areas.
Now, before you leave that, let me just clarify that.
Yes, ma'am.
And Mr. Skazko, what I believe we were trying to clarify here is there was uncertainty about the 25-foot buffer area, and there was some suggestion that it was going to end up really becoming a de facto preserve, and the tortoises would have to be retained in the buffer area just like they would in the conservation area. So we're trying to clarify that?
Yes, ma'am. Correct.
Okay.
That's exactly why.
No questions.
Okay. Madam, that is it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am.
Good morning. My name is Wes Kane. I'm a professional engineer licensed in the state of Florida, and I have been previously accepted at previous hearing examiner. My resume is on file, and I have copies with me in case you need it. And I haven't sworn it.
You've been recognized as an expert
in
as a professional engineer?
That's correct.
Okay. Staff have any objection to recognizing you?
Sam, no, ma'am, we do not.
Okay. So accepted.
So I'm going to discuss the drainage out here existing and then proposed, the general concept, and then also the utilities. So the proposed development is located in Daughtry Creek watershed. The existing condition consists of ag and pasture land bisected by the existing creek. The site primarily drains via sheet flow, generally towards the creek. The creek runs south, eventually crossing Bayshore Road and then to the Clousahatchee River. The proposed drainage, I show both of the MCPs up here with generalized flow arrows. The lakes will be interconnected, and essentially there will be, the RPD will maintain the existing flow pattern. Stormwater will be treated and stored within the proposed stormwater management system in independent basins on either side of the creek. So you'd have a basin on either side of the creek here. The stormwater management basins will discharge to the existing creek through their respective control structures. The stormwater management system will be designed to accommodate the 25-year storm event by storing the associated depth of rainfall and discharging to the creek at the allowable discharge rate for the Daughtry Creek watershed. This allowable discharge rate is based on the expected runoff from the site based on characteristics of the overall contributing watershed. So we will be generally maintaining the existing runoff rates of the watershed and property as required by Lee County Land Development Code and the South Florida Water Management District Applicant's Handbook. For utilities, we've received letters of availability for potable water from Lee County Utilities and wastewater from the Florida Governmental Utility Authority. There's a 12-inch water main located approximately 1,000 feet south on Slater Road, a 12-inch water main along Myakka Drive adjacent to the site, and 16-inch water main adjacent to the site along Williams Road. Florida Governmental Utility Authority has a 4-inch, 8-inch, and 16-inch force main located along Williams Road, Bayshore Road, and Mellow Road, respectively. The development will be designed to connect to and utilize these available existing utilities. And these are the letters of availability that we have received from Lee County Utilities and FGUA. So I'm available for any questions or comments.
Well, I have a couple questions.
Sure.
Mr. Kane, I believe you indicated that we will have to develop this property in accordance with the criteria of the South Florida Water Management District. Is that correct?
That is correct.
It's my understanding that the South Florida indicates that your post-development runoff can't exceed your pre-development runoff. For folks worried about flooding, what does that mean in common terms?
That means that this site should not have any detrimental impact on any of the surrounding properties.
So for those folks who think that the development of this site is going to cause flooding, do you have an expert opinion on that?
That is the requirement by the Land Development Code and the applicant's handbook of the South Florida Water Management District, and obviously our firm would, well, whoever the design firm is, would want to comply with that at the time of development.
Would want to, would have to comply with that, is that
absolutely
correct? And would not be allowed to cause flooding.
That's
that correct?
Correct.
I know there's been a lot of discussion since Irma, and I've seen various people write things that say we all know that new development causes flooding. And it's my understanding that that's not correct under the rules that are in place. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you or the design consultant would have to design this site to meet presently the 25-year, three-day storm event. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, I do know or keep hearing that Lee County, Estero, and Bonita are all have ongoing water management studies. Is that correct?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
And we don't know what changes, if any, will come out of that, but there may be different standards.
That is correct.
Okay. Any other questions?
All right. The follow-up question to that is, will this project have to meet whatever new standards come into place before it is developed?
Whatever the standards are for the or the Land Development Code at that time and also the applicant's handbook. That is correct.
Okay. Staff have any questions?
Yes, sir.
For the record, my name is Sam Lee, Lee County Natural Resources. Would you look at the slide of existing drainage and proposed? Mm-hmm. That just back and forth, that one existing for now, the larger, thicker arrow that they're indicating the flow in the creek, the Daughtry Creek, right?
Say that again?
Larger, thicker arrow.
That's correct.
Right. That's the flow in the Daughtry Creek.
That's correct.
From north to south. And the smaller one from the side is the existing sheet flow pattern from west toward the creek east and then from the east portion of the property toward the west for the center of the creek, right?
That yes, generally.
There should be a plug somewhere around there.
Okay.
Sorry.
I didn't cause that problem. And the proposed condition, next slide, please. Now you're changing the local that component of a sheet flow, for example, the southernmost lake under its R2, yeah, right. That one you're sending toward the north and dumping into the creek, right? I hope your design capture that. In other words, in general, sheet flow-wise, toward that creek from the western portion and the northeastern portion, same pattern kind of distributed along the progress of the river. Now you're combining it into north up to one point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's something, you know, at the time of development will be considered. You know, that'll be based on the final site plan and grading of the site. But I do understand your concern, and that's not to say that, you know, maybe we don't discharge this way or multiple points of discharge, it would all just kind of come out in the development process.
Oh, okay. So that means you don't have a ERP permit yet?
No, we do not.
Oh, okay. So this is a conceptual?
Yes, it is.
And also, I want to remind that.
You asked, do you have an ERP yet? Is that what
your
question was?
Yes.
Okay.
This site does not currently have an environmental resource permit.
Okay.
That's with the South Florida Water Management
right.
District.
Okay. That's what I thought you were.
So I just want to point out that I see there was a change. Even if you got the ERP, they consider, as Neil mentioned, that pre versus post under 25-year three-day storm.
Mm-hmm.
That's a state regulation.
That's correct.
But that's another concern that in reality, especially that last summer, hurricane is more than quite possible. It's already been we've been experiencing a 25-year, three-day storm rain event would be many cases higher, but that's what we got as regulation. So as a county, having ERP permit is okay. You may satisfy a state permit, but in the residence, as an engineer, a responsible engineer, you are mindful that, yes, we can get permit, but still, in reality, rainfall has been observing more higher than three-day rainfall or 25-year. Can you willing to consider that extra?
Well,
the answer is, I'm going to answer that.
Sure.
The project is going to comply with the regulations. I asked Mr. Kane about the fact that there's studies going on because we're mindful of the fact that there may well be changes to all the local regulations. And that relates in part to our concern about the condition that the staff has recommended, because we don't want to get trapped saying, well, you got to comply with these rules, which have been changed, and they're different and in conflict. So what we're trying to do to satisfy Mr. Lee and the public is this project is going to comply with the rules that are in effect at the time, and we recognize that in light of the things that Mr. Lee's pointed out, those regulations may very well change. We know that three local governments are all working towards that. Okay. This can't be anything different you wanted to add, but...
No, that's the direction I was going.
I agree that one. The reason I wanted to bring it up would be, you mentioned a minute ago that as long as meeting pre-discharge versus post-discharge, post-discharge is less or equal to the pre, then you are kind of assuring there was no adverse impact. Mm-hmm. Well, in practical terms, you may satisfy with the ERP state regulation, but in practical terms, we have a more frequent rain. So we don't have...
Well, some years we do.
Right. That the higher intensity, that we don't have now the tool in land development code in our hands. So as a licensed engineer and member of the public, aware of that, you may meet that state regulation, but that's not, as she implied, that one is not absolute guarantee. It's not only this particular project. Every we are living in this environment and location in the climate change area. That's what we are now. So I want to remind everybody. We do review, many of them rely on state review process, but we also realize that one, I know, clarify that, clearly communicate with the county staff and the citizens. That's what my point.
Okay, and I share somewhat of the concern in that there was a statement made that you're going to meet the county and state requirements, and therefore there will not be flooding.
Okay, that wasn't implying that.
And I think the assurance cannot be given that there will not be any flooding because of this development. Even if this development was not there, there could be flooding that occurred.
And let me clarify. I'm not saying there won't be flooding. Obviously, if you're in Houston, you have a 1,000-year storm event, you're going to have flooding. What I was trying to get at is a lot of the things that I see people write is that new development causes it. And I was trying to distinguish between the fact that if flooding's not caused by new development, because most often it's designed to a higher standard than a lot of the existing development in terms of how it has to be designed and elevation and a variety of factors.
Okay. And I think the whether new development as the current standards must meet the pre-development relative to a 25-year, three-day storm. If there is a higher storm because the ponds are designed for a certain level where there were not ponds before, those ponds may flood, and that development, because it's collected together differently. But on the other hand, there has to be some standard, some level to develop to, and it sounds like the county is looking at changing the regulations. So whatever the regulations are, you're committing that they will be met,
And what I'm trying to do in the 48-hour letter is not put ourselves in a catch-22 between current and changing regulations.
Right, and we will ask staff to respond to those suggested changes.
You know, and in light of that, you raised a question that Sam apparently is raising a question about sheep flow versus ponds. I do need to ask Mr. Kane a question. Mr. Kane, water management ponds are included because we need to provide water quality.
That's correct.
And storage.
In attenuation storage. That's correct.
And so I'm assuming nobody would give you a permit to just let the site sheep flow into Dodgers Creek without providing some kind of ponds. Is that correct?
That's correct.
The question, and I would assume it would be to you, is the reason for the second option with the larger lake on the eastern side, or larger lakes, plural, on the eastern side, from a drainage standpoint because of the...
No, it's for extra fill.
But okay. It could provide additional storage volume also.
Okay. So it provides fill to be used on site to raise up the site levels on the western side from on the eastern
it's
side.
It's an option that was included.
Okay. So it's not a stormwater reason for...
I'll let Buddy answer that.
Yeah. No, I mean, it could provide some additional benefit to the site as far as additional storage, but there's, you know, the few reasons would be that, and then also to generate fill for the site.
Well, if the two sections are divided from a drainage standpoint by Daughtry Creek going down the middle, if you had a larger lake on the eastern side that could provide more storage because of the development on the dirt is taken out. Well, the dirt will be put in on the western side, whether it comes from on-site or whether it comes from off-site, the amount of fill will be the same, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so the extra storage that it would provide would only be for the amount of rain that falls
on
the eastern side, or could it be designed so that if Daughtry Creek starts flooding, it could pop off into that lake to store or not?
Well, you know, if our site is still required to be designed at the 25-year storm event, that means there's going to be berms around the site at the 25-year storm event, and the control structure will also be built to that elevation. So if the floodwaters flowing through the floodway were to peak that 25-year, then it would pop off into that lake. Speaking on just relative elevations and 100-year storm versus 25-year storm.
Okay, so that would all be something that would be looked at the design stage, of development order stage of how it can best be used to maximize the hydrological or the stormwater management. Okay. I don't think I had any...
I have one more question.
Okay, one more question.
Also, are you aware of that there was a creek, Daughtry Creek, there was a national flood insurance program that administered by the FEMA. There was a special regulation and restriction exist on your site.
Yes, we are aware that there's a FEMA floodway that transects the site along Daughtry's Creek.
And so far, from the first slide to now, I didn't see that one shown anywhere in the master concept plan or anywhere. Why is that?
My answer for that would be the current flood insurance rate map panels that are available are from 2008, mm-hmm. unless there's been revisions, but they're always subject to change and revision. Mm-hmm. So if this site's developed in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, the limits of that floodway could change, so we wouldn't want to depict something so certain that could change in the future. Same with the development standards.
Yeah, and just for the records, the LDC 6-479 defines a floodway, the channel of a river or other riverine water course and adjacent land areas that must be reserved in order to discharge the base flood without cumulatively increasing the water surface elevation more than a foot. There's a lot of regulations that, you know, discuss what happens if you have one of those. and I believe what Mr. Kane just described is, you know, you have to look at the firm maps and that sort of thing. So, but if I don't think this definition is going to change in terms of whether that creek is a floodway. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Just the width of it that may change.
That's correct.
Okay, so there was a previous drawing that showed a heavy dash line going through on either side of the creek. That was the buffer as opposed to the floodway? I assumed it was a floodway.
Jennifer Sapin for the record. Yeah, that heavy dash line is the 25-foot waterway natural buffer.
Okay.
The blue shown there, that is the survey located top of bank of the creek right now. Of course, that can change, and that 25-foot line is offset from that. So that is correct. We don't have any references in our master concept plan to floodways because of the concerns that Wes Kane brought up about the changing maps. This is just for the buffer.
Okay. Okay, about the changing map, you said the existing flood map in that area been finalized and issued by FEMA in 2008, right?
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge, it's
so
still
about 10 years past. Have you seen anywhere during the 10-year any map change in that Dirty Creek?
I have not researched since that time, so I haven't seen if there's been any revisions.
According to my memory, says that no change made on that Dirty Creek.
Mm-hmm.
So your notion that FEMA flood map keep changing.
I didn't say keep changing, but they're subject to change.
Subject to change, yes.
I don't know when the site's going to be developed.
So in my opinion, that because it's a...
Mr. Lee testify during his time and restrict this to asking questions?
All I want would be, I want to have a floodway boundary loud and clearly showing on the master concept plan with a note with the development of the process, we have to comply with the FEMA requirements. But so far, I don't have anything shown in here.
We have a creek shown on the master concept plan. At the time of DO, we're going to have to comply with LDC Chapter 6.
Okay. Mr. Lee, we'll let you present that in the staff portion and explain what it is that you think needs to be shown and why you think it needs to be shown on there. And if there's some provision of the code that requires it to be shown or suggests that it should be shown or something like that, that would be helpful if you have the section that you can talk about when we get to the staff portion. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Ted Shreesh with TR Transportation Consultants. I've been accepted as an expert witness in transportation planning related matters and asked to be accepted this morning. My resume is on file and I have been sworn.
Any objection?
No, ma'am.
So accepted.
I'll just briefly go through the transportation analysis that was conducted as part of our application, and I'll expand on some of my comments for the benefit of the public. Our traffic study that's required at this stage of the process looked at the maximum intensity that could be developed on this site based on our zoning request. And right now, that based on the master concept plan, that maximum development intensity includes 120 multifamily dwelling units and 210 single-family detached dwelling units. And the multifamily units are simply units that are more than two or more units that are attached. So it would be typically like a townhome type product or something similar to that. As Jennifer indicated, the access to the property, we have two means of ingress and egress to the site. One is provided to Slater Road, which will be the primary entrance and exit to this facility or to this project. And then an access, basically the extension of Williams Road. Williams Road extends to the south and connects to Bayshore Road. So what we do as part of the traffic study, we look at the operations of the roadways as they currently exist, and then we project the operations at the potential build-out of this property. In this case, we looked at the year 2022, and all the volumes we looked at in this analysis are based on peak season conditions. So it's that the traffic volume during the peak season of the year, which is typically February or March here in Southwest Florida. currently, in today's conditions, both Slater Road and Bayshore Road are operating at a level service C. And our analysis showed that in 2022, based on increased traffic growth, based on historical traffic patterns, so we increased the background traffic to look at a growth in trips that will anticipated to occur between now and 2022. When you add the background traffic growth in, both Bayshore and Slater are still shown at a C, and then when we add the trips from our project in, those roadways will continue to operate at a level service C. And as you're aware, the Lee County Comprehensive Plan indicates that an acceptable level service on the roadways is a level service E. We're well above the minimum recommended levels of service that the county's comprehensive plan evaluates and requires in terms of projects, in terms of meeting the transportation evaluations. There'll have to be another traffic study done when this project comes in for final site plan approval, the local development order process. At that time, we'll know exactly what's being proposed to be developed, how many single family, how many multifamily, et cetera. And at that time, we look at any specific off-site improvements that need to be done. Specifically, will we have to do any turn lanes on Slater Road at the site entrance? And there's administrative code provisions that we must follow that identify when and if turn lanes will be required based on the conditions at the time that this project comes in for development. And that leads me to the last point, and I just want to say the staff report had attachment H, which is the memorandum from Development Services from Mr. Evans, and we're in agreement with everything that's in that report. His conclusions match and mirror my conclusions of my traffic report in terms of the impacts of this project on the surrounding roadway network. But one thing I wanted to bring up was in his memo, he recommended a condition that's included in the conditions as condition 5 in the staff report. And I just wanted to read that condition. It's condition 5 called turn lanes. Now, the condition that is in the staff report reads, turn lane deceleration length designs for corresponding design speeds will be the greater of that described in the Lee County Administrative Code 11-4, which is titled Turn Lane Policy, and the Florida Department of Transportation Design Standard Index 301, which is called Turn Lanes. Then it goes on to say, design speed as applied to deceleration length design in both documents will be not less than 5 miles per hour greater than the higher of the legal speed limit and, if available, the 85th percentile speed as determined by Lee County approved traffic engineering study. And that's the wording of the condition. Mike, the issue we have is I have not seen this language before, and I'm not sure if it's been proposed in other zoning cases, but there is an administrative code that the Board of County Commissioners has identified that addresses turn lane requirements at the development order stage. In our opinion, this is more of a general policy statement, and our opinion is this project isn't any more, doesn't require anything specific to be called out that would require us to look at something above and beyond what is included in the administrative code. In my opinion, if the county wants to require this, the 85th percentile speed, that language is not in the administrative code, or other language, they should amend the administrative code so it applies to every project that's coming in. And again, this goes to the condition just as we described earlier, that if there is a change in the administrative code between now and the time this project seeks development order, you know, now we're saddled with a condition that may be in conflict with the administrative code. It may be the exact same language. We just don't know at this time. So our contention is that, you know, there is an administrative code that the board has adopted that we must follow to look at turn lanes. This condition is really going above and beyond that. You know, I'll say from my experience, every turn lane that I've recommended in traffic studies on a Lee County roadway is always based on the design speed of the posted speed plus 5. So that's just been our working order since I've been down and doing traffic studies in Lee County since 1999. So if staff's concerned, and we'll have to hear from them on what their issues are in terms of why they want to include this condition, but we should be subject to the administrative codes that are enforced at the time that we come in for a development order. And again, having language in the zoning condition that might conflict with something that's in a future administrative code, that's just what we're trying to avoid. So that's my comments. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
I just have one question, Mr. Treish. Did you find anything in the staff memo that justified a different standard for this project?
No.
Staff have a question?
I'm hearing examiner, I do have maybe a single question. It might be a two-part question for Ted. Ted, when you did the background traffic for this particular project, was part of that background traffic just looking at what amount of traffic was on Slater Road as part of your analysis, what was existing on Slater Road?
Yes.
And can you give an idea, when I said the word existing, can you give an idea of where that information came from a date standpoint?
We take it from the Lee County Concurrency Report that's published every year. Our traffic study looked at the time our TIS was completed was the 2015 report, the 2016 report. The 2017 is now out, and that information was included in Marcus's memo, but it didn't have any change in our analysis in terms of the levels of service.
And your knowledge of the roadway systems out there, I apologize, I got one other question. To your knowledge of the roadway system out there, was the connection of Del Prado Extension and to Mello to Slater in existence in 2015, in 2016?
I believe it was, yes.
Thank you. That's all the questions I had, Madam Hearing
Examiner. I just have one more question. Mr. Treish, will another traffic analysis be required before development can be obtained for this project?
Yes, we'll have to do another TIS.
Data is available at that point in time.
Yes, we'll have to use the most current traffic data available.
Thank you.
Okay, so you said that the studies are done in February, March, to get the peak information each year.
Well, the studies aren't necessarily done, but because of the volume of data that's collected, even if we collect data in July or August, we have adjustment factors that we can apply that will, based on historical traffic data that is collected for a 12-month period, we apply that adjustment factor to the data if it's collected outside those months to raise it up to the peak season levels.
Okay. No other questions from staff?
No, ma'am.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Do we want to take a real short break?
Sure.
Yes.
Okay. We will take a break until 11:15.
Okay. And pick up the staff at that.
Yes. Okay. Well, no, I think they have one more witness.
Okay. That's fine.
So we will.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Let's do it.